Hi everyone, I'm Chris Saldana and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. This month, we're interviewing Drs. Sarah Lenhoff, Jeremy Singer, and Catherine Michelmore. Dr. Lenhoff is the Leonard Kaplan Endowed Professor at Wayne State University's College of Education. Dr. Singer is a postdoctoral researcher at Michigan State University. And Dr. Michelmore is an associate professor at the University of Michigan's Ford School of Public Policy. In the first part of this month's episode, Drs. Lenhoff and Singer discuss their approach to educational policy and research, emphasizing the importance of an ecological perspective. So historically, schools have been thought of as a center of learning. So for example, you might think about the three R's, writing, reading, and arithmetic. You both, along with Michael Gottfried, led a special issue in the Peabody Journal of Education, arguing for an ecological perspective to educational policy. So how does an ecological perspective change how we think about what goes on in schools and how we think about the role of society in schools?
Yeah, so I mean, I think we think about this as, you know, children aren't just students in schools, right? I mean, it's an obvious fact, right? Children come from families that live in neighborhoods, that live in cities, situated in states with a policy context, in countries with a policy and social context, and that all of that context kind of matters for what children get out of school, whether they can show up in school, how they engage with their peers and their teachers, the meaning they make out of their education. And, you know, a lot of our work has focused on, you know, how all of these things impact whether kids even show up at all. But, you know, it also kind of emerges in, you know, what they get out of school when they get there. So I think a lot of ed reform discourse and policy over the last couple of decades has really focused very narrowly on what's going on in schools, right? That schools are the answer to all the kind of social ills that we might face around inequality and racism. And an ecological perspective really pushes us to kind of step back from that narrow lens and ask, how does all of this context outside of schools actually impact what's going on in schools and you know, affect whether schools can achieve the goals that we've laid out for them, you know, whether they can achieve reading, writing, and arithmetic goals, right, for their students.
Now, I'll only add that I think it's clearly what we're describing here is not, it's a synthesis. It's not new thought. It's a synthesis of the insights of many, many generations of research and educational leadership thought. I think one thing that we would want to stress is that we can think both about how things outside of the domain of education impact students' educational outcomes and opportunities, and then also how they impact the very experiences that they have within schools as well. So you can imagine that something like a tax credit helps an individual family, it improves the developmental context or the opportunities for those students potentially. And you can understand why on an individual level that would benefit them and their learning over the long term. Also, if you were to infuse an entire community or school community with greater level of assets and resources, that might have a multiplicative effect for the experiences day to day that students are having with each other and with their teachers and school leaders in their schools, right? So we both think that it's important to think about how things like housing and employment and social welfare, that these have a positive impact for individual families, but also how those can really seep into the fabric of the learning experience ultimately.
But Jeremy, you mentioned housing, employment. When you think about those kinds of policies, how might listeners make sense of how those policies enter into schooling, enter into the lives of students? How does it change a student learning math, for example? Like, what are some of the examples that you're thinking about in terms of educational policies where there's these connections?
I think it would be helpful for us to use student attendance as an example. That's where a lot of our thinking on this is informed. Although, as Sarah mentioned, it also applies to students learning, for example, in math or English or science or social studies. But you take, you know, the issue of absenteeism, which is on folks' minds coming through the pandemic. What research that we've done prior to the pandemic and through it has shown is that there are many, many obstacles and barriers for students facing socioeconomic adversity to get to school on a consistent and regular basis. So they're likely to miss a few days of school, whether that's a few days a month or a few days a week, because they have a variety of different issues. It could be instability in terms of their housing situation. It could be difficulty affording transportation, maintaining access to a car, or it could relate to challenges with work schedules and strains on parental time. So these are examples of like lots of factors that are beyond the scope of schools alone that really impact students' ability to be there in school on a daily basis.
Yeah. And so, I mean, the implications of that then are, you know, something that we measure in schools, like student attendance or chronic absence, something that most states are holding schools and therefore school leaders accountable for, their student attendance. An ecological perspective would require us to really reconsider that focus on accountability for a school to solve this issue that is largely outside of their direct scope of influence, and then ask what other sorts of social policies need to be put in place to ensure that students can get to school, right? If we care about this as an outcome, then how do we not only kind of put the lens of accountability and, you know, potentially resources in schools, but how do we think about our public infrastructure for transportation so youth can get to school? How do we think about employment policy so that parents aren't working schedules that make it incompatible with them supporting their children to get to school? Things like that.
And I'll just add that then to bring the lens back onto schools, because I think the one point here is that we want to push forward policies in all these different domains. But there are plenty of educators and educational leaders who might say, well, I don't really have control right now over those things. And one thing we would add is that, you know, so there's a political dimension to this in terms of the, you know, the role of educational leaders and other actors who kind of help set the terms or set the agenda for conversations about what we need in education. But also when we think about the sort of immediate, what's an educational leader or a teacher supposed to do today on an issue like attendance? We hope at least that this perspective helps think about the merit and the impact of the different kinds of practices that they might adopt, right? So running with this attendance example, like a lot of schools try and focus on communication-based interventions, incentives. And I think, you know, there are ways that those kinds of practices can be beneficial, but it's important to acknowledge that they're going to have like a moderate impact for families who are facing, you know, these broader out of school barriers, and so that schools can sort of in the moment prioritize practices that recognize that context and try to attend to it while still, you know, participating in the longer term kind of coalitional work that might be needed to address those out of school factors as well.
It strikes me that moving from this belief of working just on what's within our control within the educational space and then not paying as much attention to some of these other policies does require a shift in thinking about governance structures, how we work together across different fields and institutions and organizations. So I'm wondering if you all have thought a bit about how governance changes within an ecological perspective and what kinds of changes that might make for students.
Definitely. This is a key question. If we're going to kind of move ed policy to an ecological arrangement, that means that we need to think about the arrangement of our social institutions, right? We have thought a lot about this. One thing that we've considered is that, you know, it may be that schools are really well positioned to serve a central organizing role in coordinating resources across students' ecosystems. So for instance, you know, we're interested in things like the community schools model that tries to bring in, you know, health, education, employment, mental health services, all kinds of things for the family and community into the school building. because schools, public schools in the U.S. are ubiquitous. They're in almost every community. People generally really trust them. So there is something there to schools and public education being an important system on which you might build an ecological model for education. Right now, we don't invest in schools in such a way that they can serve that role. In fact, in a lot of cases, we're asking them to do that work without providing them the resources and infrastructure to do it well. And so what you end up seeing is, you know, we have folks working in schools trying to be caseworkers, trying to be, you know, social workers, trying to case manage major socioeconomic issues, for instance, for families. And they can't do it, right? Because they have caseloads of 300, 400, 500 families. They have very few resources. There's very little kind of data infrastructure to, for instance, share data between schools, social service systems, housing coalitions, other things that families might be engaged in. So I think it would require a real intentionality around schools serving this role, and then what kinds of, you know, both material and social and personnel resources they might need.
So when you think about an ecological perspective and what it means for policy change, for practice, how these two things engage with politics, what are some of the areas or topics that you've mentioned absenteeism, for example, or attendance? What are some of the areas that you see as maybe the low-hanging fruit, or where we might be able to start as a field, or community members may be able to advocate for? I assume most of them probably are already. What are those areas?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's funny that you ask it, because so I work really closely with a coalition of community organizations in Detroit who are trying to improve student attendance here. And, you know, they have really, over time, adopted this ecological framing for themselves, really come to understand, you know, the problem of absenteeism as stemming from structural inequality and not about kind of individual motivation for the most part. But then figuring out what to do with that information, I think, is really tough because, you know, kind of individual organizations or individual people, right, can't solve all the issues at one time, right? So what we've been thinking about is, how do we, you know, invest our efforts into maybe one domain that is keeping students from school, and try to develop proof of concepts on the kind of individual school or system level, such that we might advocate for bigger policy change. So, for instance, transportation is a major problem in Detroit. How might we work closely with a few individual schools to pilot, you know, new ideas around transportation? And even the single issue of transportation is, you know, exists in an ecosystem. So those ideas would probably have to include things like, you know, maybe some more busing, maybe some consideration of how to support families in enrolling in schools that are closer to their homes. How do you focus on community neighborhood groups and Black groups to develop safe walking paths for students who can walk or bike to school? How do you make sure that kids who want to bike have bikes? You know, how do you maybe pay for bikes, pay for bike locks, make sure that they have secure ways to, you know, leave their bike at school when they're in class? So, you know, it's not, even just picking one topic doesn't mean it's one solution, but doing that and investing, you know, in one domain that if you solved on a bigger level could have a really big impact, might help to produce the evidence that you would need for an advocacy, you know, coalition to, you know, create an agenda that they're lobbying for on a bigger level.
And then I think there's room for experimentation, I guess, piloting different efforts. So Sarah's speaking to what community organizations and local education agencies might be able to do with the resources they already have. And so I think it would be really great to see foundations, philanthropy, government even willing to fund efforts to intervene in other domains than just like sort of immediately in the classroom or the school, but with education in mind. So I'll give an example of like a school focused one, and then I can speak to some that are outside of school that we might think about. So Connecticut actually had a really good example again on this topic of attendance. During the pandemic, they funded a randomized control trial for basically a casework approach to solving attendance issues. So in like four or five districts in Connecticut, it was called the LEAP program, L-E-A-P. Four or five districts, students were randomly assigned to have like a caseworker. Caseloads ranged from around three or four students to as many as maybe 20, which is important to say because of what we were talking about earlier in terms of capacity and burden on the folks who actually have to carry out this work. And there's some pretty promising evidence that that model really did a good job in improving students' attendance. And so, you know, there's good evidence that on at least to some degree, if we are able to fund people who can problem solve with families and help identify resources that help them overcome barriers, then that can be really helpful. Now, obviously, those personnel would be really expensive, especially when you think of what those caseloads look like. And if you think of places with, you know, very high rates of chronic absenteeism, so that's just an example of like a sort of proof point. It's great that that's something that other schools and districts might be able to emulate, but it's a good example of how you need to put money behind it in order to actually demonstrate it, because just asking schools or just to try those things with their existing resources might be difficult. And then beyond just like the school or district itself. So Sarah's involved in a project related to low-income housing project and development in Detroit. And, you know, that's a good example. Like there's an education component to the evaluation of that. So that's good that at least in the housing domain, they are thinking about, well, what could be the educational impact on housing affordability and housing stability for residents in the city. And then, you know, I mean, there's the baby's first year study where they're just doing direct cash transfers. So that's at like the very earliest developmental stages of children's lives. But it'd be interesting if there are places that are trying universal income that they might try and design those things with students' educational outcomes in mind. So are there ways to evaluate the impact for the children and the families who are receiving those funds? But those are examples of like, you know, it'd be really interesting and great to see if there were ways to just fund these sort of pilot programs that bridge the divide between education and other domains. And essentially what that would mean is having like experts on education and experts in these domains coming together, hopefully around a nice, you know, chunk of change that can help you pilot one of these things in order to see what the effects might be. You know, even if you think about the U.S. Department of Education, I'm not sure what the, you know, the regulations or barriers would be to this, but it would be really interesting to see a U.S. Department of Education or, you know, an Institute of Education Sciences grant that was not only focused on some sort of educational intervention like instruction or the personnel, but if they also had a grant that helped bridge those silos. So, you know, in a way, funders could potentially play a role by encouraging those sorts of projects.
In the second part of this month's episode, Professor Michel Moore discusses the significance of tax credit policies within a policy framework that supports students outside of school.
So for listeners who aren't familiar with tax credit policies, what are they and what are they designed to do?
Yeah, so there's a couple big tax credit policies we think about in this space. So I'll mostly be talking about the earned income tax credit, but also the child tax credit. So both of these programs, the EITC and the CTC, are really designed to provide income transfers to working families with children. So in the case of the EITC, it's also particularly targeted towards low-income working families. And so it was originally designed as a way to both incentivize families, low-income families to work, but also as a way to provide some tax relief for these low-income workers. The idea being that families shouldn't be taxed into poverty, essentially, if they're working. And so the EITC was essentially established with that motivation that, you know, we shouldn't be taxing people into poverty. The child tax credit had somewhat of a similar implementation in that it was designed to provide tax relief for families. It stretches higher into the income distribution than the EITC does. And in fact, the child tax credit actually deliberately excludes the poorest children in the U.S. So historically, about a third of the poorest children in the U.S. have been completely left out of, or not completely, but have not been able to claim the full benefit. So it was originally targeted towards kind of middle income families. But these credits can be quite generous. So the EITC, for instance, last year was worth more than $7,000 up to that amount for families with three children or more. And they're designed through the tax code, or they're distributed through the tax code. So the nice thing about that is that it doesn't require an additional administrative hurdle compared to some other programs like food stamps or cash welfare. It does, of course, though, require that you file your taxes to claim it.
What do we know about how effective these policies are?
Yeah, so the EITC has been around a lot longer than the CTC. So the EITC we've had since 1975, and there's been kind of a lot of expansions to the program over time. A lot of states have implemented their own EITCs. And so researchers have taken advantage of this policy variation to kind of study the impact of being exposed to these larger benefits. And so there's a host of research on the impacts of the EITC, some of which I've contributed to myself. So I'll focus on what we know about kids. So studies have shown that kids who, or I should say, I guess their parents who receive the EITC while pregnant, those kids are less likely to be born low birth weight, which is, a proxy for success in later life. So it's not a great thing to be born low birth weight. So there's evidence to show that the EITC reduces your chances of being born low birth weight. Once kids are in childhood, we see evidence that they're in better health, that they have higher test scores. In some of my own work, I've done work showing that kids who are exposed to larger benefits in childhood go on to complete high school at higher rates. They're more likely to complete college, and they go on to have higher earnings in adulthood, which means they're less likely to live in poverty as adulthood. So it's been really shown to essentially break this intergenerational cycle of poverty that I think we've worried about for a long time, is that, being born into poverty or growing up in poverty kind of dooms you to be poor once you're an adult. So I think the nice thing about that EITC is it shows that, this is a policy decision, that we can actually use social policy to help break that cycle. I can talk a little bit about the CTC too. There's not as much evidence on that credit, mostly because it's a more recent credit. So I shouldn't say recent, it was established in the 1990s, but there's just less evidence on it because there haven't been as many changes to the policy over time. So actually what we do know about it is from a recent reform a couple years ago. There is also some evidence that shows that families who received the child tax credit were also less likely to have babies born low birth weight. So that's pretty consistent with the EITC. And we're still kind of waiting to see longer term effects on kids. But we know that it helped kind of reduce families' food insecurity. For some families, it helped them get caught up on rent. And so there's evidence that it's kind of improving the household stability in terms of food insecurity and perhaps financial stability as well.
Are there any serious barriers to accessing these tax credits? You mentioned that, one of the things is you have to file a tax return. So are there challenges to accessing these benefits?
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked that, because there absolutely are. And I think, in some sense, like I had said before, putting these credits in the tax code is nice in that it reduces some of the stigma associated with social policies. So historically, programs like welfare and food stamps have come associated with a stigma cost to them. And so we worry that some families don't want to claim these benefits because they are concerned about the stigma. So the nice thing I think about putting these benefits in the tax code is that it reduces some of that stigma, because you don't have to go fill out extra paperwork at a welfare office. You're filing your taxes just like everybody else. In the case of the earned income tax credit, it has this term earned in the description of it. And so qualitative evidence suggests that people really view this as something that they deserve, that it's something that's theirs. That being said, there are certainly downsides to how it's structured too. So like I said, you have to file your taxes, and some families aren't required to file taxes. If your income is below a certain threshold, you're not required to file. So for particularly low income families, that filing might be a particularly large burden because it's not something they're used to doing. We saw that actually with some of the reforms to the child tax credit a couple of years ago, and that there were a lot of families that were historically kind of disconnected from the tax system that were scrambling to try to gain eligibility through a website that the IRS had set up. So we know that poses a challenge. you know, getting in a little bit of the details of the program itself, both the EITC and the Child Tax Credit have a Social Security number requirement. So in the case of the EITC, everybody in the tax filing unit has to have a Social Security number in order to claim the benefit. So mixed status households or any households where, you know, somebody in the household doesn't have a Social Security number, they can't claim any tax filing unit. They can't claim the credit. For the child tax credit, the child is the one who has to have the Social Security number. So it's a little bit of a less restrictive policy. But that was a change that was made actually just a few years ago during the 2017 tax reform. They imposed that extra restriction that kids have to have a Social Security number to claim the credit. The last thing I would say is that, you know, the tax code is just confusing and complex in general. And so, you know, in the case, both of these policies have, these credits have restrictions on who's eligible to claim in terms of you have to meet residency requirements, for instance. So in order to claim a child, the child has to live in the household for at least 6 months of the year, which maybe for many families is not a huge barrier, but for kids who are perhaps spending their time across different households, if they have divorced parents or they have custody agreements, that can be kind of challenging for families because there could be multiple adults that appear eligible to claim the child, and it causes some confusion about who's actually entitled to claim the credit. And we know, you know, based on demographic patterns, that this is disproportionately going to hurt lower income families because they tend to have more complex family living arrangements.
So during the pandemic, the federal government expanded tax credits. Do we know what impact that had on children and families?
Yeah, so during 2021, there were two big changes to, there's a big change to the EITC and a big change to the child tax credit, both of which were temporary. They expired at the end of 2021. So for the EITC, you know, one of the big criticisms of the EITC is it doesn't do a whole lot for people who don't on paper look like they have children. So if you're not, as I said, you know, you have to meet these residency requirements in order to claim children. So it means that there's a lot of potentially a lot of non-custodial parents out there that, you know, look like they don't have children in terms, you know, in the eyes of the IRS, but they might be financially supporting children. And the EITC basically doesn't have a whole lot of benefit. Like it has a very small credit available for those folks. In 2021, they actually tripled the size of that benefit. So it used to be a maximum $500. They tripled it to over about $1,500 for those tax filers. So again, on paper, it kind of looks like it's just impacting people who don't have children. But because of the way the tax code is written, a childless tax filer could be a non-custodial parent or some other relative that might be supporting children, but they don't meet the requirements to be able to claim those kids. So we don't know a whole lot yet about how that particular expansion impacted families with children, aside from the fact that we know that it reduced poverty among those folks, those childless filers. The other big reform that happened in 2021 was to the child tax credit. It used to be worth about up to $2,000 per child. They increased that to $3,000 per child age 6 to 17 and $3,600 for kids under 6. And they also made it essentially a universal credit. So I said it earlier that, you know, so lots of low-income kids weren't eligible for the maximum CTC benefit. In 2021, essentially almost all children, over 90% of children in the U.S. were eligible for this benefit. And it was also distributed for the first time as a monthly credit for the for 6 months of the year. So it meant that instead of families waiting to file their taxes and get their return that they do, you know, around April of every year, they could get that credit on a month-to-month basis. So that really changes, I think, what families do with the money. So getting a regular payment like that, for instance, researchers have shown that it helps families reduce food insecurity because it's essentially helping them meet their monthly expenses. Whereas something more like a lump sum credit that you get at tax time is more helpful for families making larger purchases. So it's more helpful in helping, for instance, families catch up on their rent and you know, kind of handling bigger expenses. So I think that was kind of one of the key results of those findings is that these monthly benefits essentially helped families reduce their food insecurity. It also led to a dramatic decline in child poverty towards the end of 2021. We don't yet have evidence on some of these other outcomes that we'd like to see about like kids' academic outcomes, but certainly I think it's a reassuring sign that we see these positive effects on food insecurity, for instance.
So given the lessons that we've learned about tax credits, What recommendations would you make to policymakers?
Well, I guess I'd say a couple of things. One thing I think that we've learned from this is that it's typically the lowest income or the lower income households that tend to benefit most from these types of income transfers. So I think we should keep that in mind in thinking towards the future of how we might design these credits. I will say, because most of the evidence we have on how tax credits impact kids comes from the earned income tax credit, one thing we don't have a great sense of is exactly what's happening, what's kind of going on under the hood that's impacting, that's leading to better outcomes for kids. We don't know if it's getting a large lump of money every year that's helping kids. We don't know if it's the work incentives that are embedded in the program. It's probably a bit of both of those things. But that's something that's still a bit of an unknown, is exactly how these credits are benefiting families kind of in real time. The last thing I would say, though, is that, you know, I think some of the work that I have done, you know, we've studied the impacts of these credits on kids, you know, into adulthood. Necessarily, that requires that we have decades of data on these kids that we can evaluate kind of the long-term benefits. And so I think what that highlights is that when we're doing these cost-benefit analyses, we can't just think about things in the short term. We can't just think about how much is it going to cost in the next 5 years and what are the benefits. We really need to think on a longer term time horizon to think about how these policies might affect generations to come. And so I know that that's kind of a difficult thing to say to people who are operating on 5 year and 10 year budget estimates. But I think that that's really crucial here, is that a lot of research has shown that, you know, these policies can kind of pay for themselves, in the sense that if you look at the long-term gains that they produce, it's much larger than the cost of the program in a given year. So I think looking towards the future, keeping that in mind, that we might not see the benefits of some of these policies for several years to come. So we should kind of be patient and wait until we can see the evidence before making any kind of broad conclusions.
Thank you, Drs. Lenhoff, Singer, and Michelmore, for being on this month's podcast. As always, we hope you're safe and healthy. And remember that for the latest analysis on educational policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu.